Ah, the good old days when you could laugh about German fascism on American TV.
Yes, yes, yes. What is it, Colonel Hogan? I'm very busy. Paperwork from Berlin. No one has any idea.
Berlin today is a city known more for body-piercing and techno music than goose-stepping stormtroopers, and Barack Obama is going to get his own love parade there today. A change agent meets a changed city. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 24th. Today, Barack Obama is in Germany meeting with the chancellor. John McCain's in Ohio talking to voters and taking shots at the media. Day three in the historic Guantanamo Bay trial of Osama bin Laden's former driver. And the FBI, well, it turns 100 years old this week. Those stories and the rest of the day's news. Barack Obama arrived in Berlin today, where he'll meet with Chancellor Angela Merkel. Also expected a major speech on U.S.-European relations he'll give to a crowd estimated to be at least 100,000 people. Germany is the first of a three-country tour this week for him, including Britain and France. The eye of Tropical Storm Dolly is about 75 miles northwest of Brownsville, Texas. Officials from Texas to Mexico are increasingly worried about flooding. Some areas have already gotten up to a foot of rain, and more is expected today. Richard Knobb, a hurricane specialist, says it could be downgraded to a tropical depression later today.
It's no longer over the water, which provides its fuel, so we expect gradual weakening during the day today.
At least 50,000 customers are now without power.
Within days, the housing rescue bill that could help 400,000 homeowners with their mortgages may be law. It cleared the House and is expected to quickly pass the Senate. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The victory is a victory for the American people and for restoring our economic strength.
The bill would also shore up government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Pakistan wants to upgrade its fighter jets, and the U.S. State Department is trying to help. It's asking Congress to let it use two-thirds of the money proposed for anti-terrorism programs for Pakistan to upgrade its aging warplanes.
A 12-mile oil spill on the Mississippi River has crews working overtime, cleaning up thousands of gallons of heavy tar-like fuel near New Orleans after a tanker ran into a barge early yesterday. The Coast Guard has closed nearly 100 miles of river, and reportedly the pilot of the tugboat involved did not have a proper license. In politics, while Barack Obama is in Germany, bad weather has delayed John McCain's scheduled trip to New Orleans. He's in Ohio today. He's holding a town hall event with fellow cancer survivor Lance Armstrong.
Boy, that John McCain cannot get a break, can he?
What percentage of the mainstream media is in the tank for Barack Obama?
Oh, by 90%.
That, of course, is the buzz on cable television and all the news pundit shows. What do you think? Do you think 90% of the media is in the tank with Barack Obama?
That sounds extraordinary. Interesting he would be in the minds of 90% of the media.
Well, 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can weigh in on this subject, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. By the way, oil's trading at $124 a barrel. And the
$124? Is that a joke? Is it April Fool's, John?
It's an oil depression, Adora. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 24th. In the wake of the catastrophic Chinese earthquake in May, some parents of the nearly 10,000 children who died are accusing Chinese officials of trying to pay them off. Accusing officials of interrogating parents who are demanding answers and threatening beatings or punishments against those who refuse to back off. Chinese officials had promised a new era of openness, but a New York Times reports today that what's happening is anything but that. Joining us for more is the New York Times China correspondent, Edward Wong. Welcome, Edward.
Hi, how are you?
What exactly are the parents being offered?
Well, are being offered a flat-out cash payment as well as pension. The cash payment in most cases is in the range of around $8,000 to $10,000 U.S. How much that pension will be, but they'll get that $8,000 to $10,000 cash up front. And in return, the parents are being asked to no longer protest over this shoddy school construction and to no longer demand that the school construction be investigated.
Are the parents being asked? I mean, you actually got a hold of one of the compensation contracts, and it sounds as if there's a bit of coercion involved. It sounds as if it was written as if the parents were actually asking for the money.
That's right. The contract, when you read the language in the contract, it sounds almost Orwellian in that it's the parents are praising the government, they're praising the party and the state for helping them out, when in fact, when you interview the parents, they're actually criticizing the government for not following through on this investigation, and they're only accepting the money because the government officials are telling them, if you don't sign here and take this money now, you'll never get any money to help you out in the future. And in Chinese society, parents rely on their children to help support them as they get older. These parents are basically facing a future with no children to do that. And so they feel very financially vulnerable. And so a lot of them have gone ahead and signed this contract.
What's the dilemma that these families who are suffering and still mourning, what are they facing as they look at this contract?
Well, like I said, they're basically facing a future where they might not have financial safety net if they don't sign on this, and also they might face, they're thinking that they might face a prolonged legal battle against the government in which the government probably won't give much way, and so maybe they think that this is all they're going to get out of pressing their case. So they're going to sign on to this contract. It's almost like, in a way, it's almost like an out-of-court settlement, the way that the contract is structured, that they'll get some sort of compensation, but that they completely drop their demands for a case against the government.
But how would you describe how they're being asked? You've reported in your piece about essentially interrogations, that the parents are being interrogated.
Right. There's one case. A leader of one of the parent groups we interviewed said that he was arrested along with 10 other parents or so at a protest last week. Some of those parents were reportedly beaten by the police, and this man was interrogated. He was held interrogated for 12 hours in police station, and then during that interrogation, he was asked to sign the contract, and also he was asked to sign a piece of paper saying that he had disturbed the social order.
I guess, Edward, I would wonder, how is this different? And, you know, I suspect it probably is, but it does sound like the Chinese version of federal disaster insurance, where you're made to sign something where you waive all claims in return for some sort of stipend. That's not something that's unusual to China, is it?
Granted, I haven't been living in China very long, but I haven't heard about this type of contract being offered in a lot of places in exactly this language. Certainly, the Chinese government does buy off when there is some sort of protest. They oftentimes offer money to people, and people will take that and then drop the protest. And basically, that's what's happening here. I think the language in the contract is also implying to the parents that you can't even talk about this. You can't protest over this issue. You can't talk to journalists about this. You can't raise questions anymore about this. The language is basically saying you can't disturb reconstruction efforts or the social order going forward. It's not just that you can't bring a legal case against the government.
So much for China's new era of openness. Edward Wong, thank you.
Thanks.
Edward Wong is the New York Times correspondent in China, and he was coming to us from China, as you might have suspected, with that crackly line there.
We take you now to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. On the phone with us is Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today, who's covering day three of the Hamdan trial. For those of you who need to know the details, Salim Hamdan is the alleged former Osama bin Laden driver who's on trial in a military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay for assisting the 9/11 hijackers and aiding terrorism in the United States. Alan Gomez, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
What happened at the trial yesterday, the specific testimony from the prosecution and the rather dramatic reaction from the defense?
Well, what you had was they introduced the interrogation tapes of Mr. Hamdan from right after when he was capture in Afghanistan. There are two videos, both of them very dark. He's on the floor, and he's, at the time, saying that he's just a simple worker for a relief agency. He has no idea what those surface-to-air missiles in the trunk are, and kind of going over that, explaining that he has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, that he has no idea what they're doing. These tapes weren't supposed to be introduced until quite a bit later, so it was quite a surprise that they were brought in so early.
Why do you think they were brought in early?
Well, you know, that's a question we had for the prosecution that obviously they didn't get into. But it was interesting because it came right after a full day of testimony from an FBI agent who interrogated Hamdan while he was in Guantanamo, where he was readily admitting that he was an Al-Qaeda, explaining his role and pretty much giving a top to bottom of the hierarchy, what they did and what their responsibilities were.
When you look at the tapes there in open court, do you get the sense, just personally, that the next step for something like this is to maybe raise the stakes and do a little harder questioning? Because it sounds to me from what you're saying that these original interrogation tapes aren't terribly believable as an account of what Salim Hamdan was doing with the surface-to-air missiles in his trunk.
Exactly. It's, you know, whether that should prompt any kind of heightened interrogation, I don't think I'll get into that. But it was, you know, it was clearly the interrogator is, you know, accusing him of lying throughout. The stories that he's telling are quite hard to believe. That day he said he was going off to some other city to buy a car because the prices were a little cheaper over there. Mm. So when you find somebody with surface-to-air missiles, he's got all sorts of radios. He's got, or he had one radio. He had code cards with Al-Qaeda codes in the car, several passports, passport pictures, $1,900 in cash. So when he has all that in the car and presented it with his story, it's easy to believe why the interrogator did not buy a story.
So at the very least, they're making the case to the military commissioners that perhaps he wasn't being credible here, and so some other sort of interrogation tactics were called for. Adora?
Alan, how would you describe Hamdan's demeanor in that tape? Did he seem like he was confident? Did he seem scared? How would you depict what you saw?
There was two videos. In the first one, he's quite animated. He's, you know, actually asks questions of the interrogator. He, you know, gives a couple of responses that are, you know, you could almost describe as comical. He asks him what he was doing with $1,900. He's like, "What's wrong with money? You may have a problem with it, but I don't." But then go to the second tape, and he is much more subdued. He is answering in very basic, you know, responses. He's not getting into that sort of back and forth. He's just answering the questions.
Wow.
He's asking if he can shift his how he's sitting, and you can see him kind of rubbing his ankles, rubbing his wrists, and yawning at several times. So, you know, what happened in between there? Who knows?
Alan, quickly before we go, you know, for years you have seen this in the abstract, this whole Guantanamo process. All of a sudden it's being played out in evidence in an open courtroom. What are your impressions of what this is going to reveal? And we just have a few seconds.
Well, it's just these kind of things, the relationships that they have with Al-Qaeda, the hearing the reaction of Osama bin Laden after 9/11, seeing, you know, firsthand how these interrogations are conducted, is, like you said, it's just really startling to see after so many years of just coming and hearing about them.
It's quite a catharsis. Alan Gomez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alan Gomez, a reporter for USA Today, covering the Hamdan trial down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 24th, and we're asking you this morning, there are some pundits out there who say that 90% of the media are on the side of Barack Obama as the presidential election looms.
In the tank.
In the tank. Not sure what that means, but they're certainly in favor of Obama. What do you think? Is that true? Is McCain getting a raw deal? Tell us your thoughts. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now we're going to take a look at some demographics. America is quickly getting older, and that shift will fully bloom in the next 30 years, where they'll just be where there will be as many people over 80 years old as there are under 5 years old. But apparently we're saving less for old age, having fewer children, and the medical community among so many communities is not adjusting well to this new world order. There'll be plenty of pediatricians to take care of all those children. There just simply won't be enough geriatricians to look after their grandparents. Already today, there is a shortage of those doctors who specialize in elderly care, one for every 2,500 Americans over 25. Dr. Jessica Colburn, you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Chief resident at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. It's going to be a lonely road, isn't it?
Yes, it looks like there aren't as many geriatricians as we would hope in the next few years, but our hope is that more of us will become excited about this field and start to join in.
Dr. Colburn, you're just starting your career in geriatrics with a fellowship next year. You say it's not necessarily the sexiest of medical practices. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess often when we think about what makes medicine exciting, the things that we think about are procedure-based, the opportunity to save lives, the opportunity to jump in when people are in a crisis and make a difference for them. And so I think the fields we think about in that category meet more don't quite fall into the category of geriatrics, which is a little bit different focus in the care of patients.
So it's no accident that there's not a TV show, Geriatrician, like
right.
There is ER?
Right. I guess it doesn't have the same kind of excitement that the ER does as far as the jumping in, saving lives, doing procedures kind of thing.
So what attracted you to a form of medicine where you're not necessarily going to be trying to prolong life?
Well, I think for me, there's a variety of things. I mean, I think the first one is that, to me, what it means to be a doctor is the opportunity to sit and talk with people to help them focus their own personal goals on making their medical decisions and matching those two things up. And I think geriatrics is the best opportunity for that. In addition, I think geriatric patients are complicated. It's an interesting medical challenge to think about a variety of complex medical conditions and how one cares for all of those while still maintaining a patient and family's goals and wishes for their own quality of life.
I mean, you say that people always ask you, why do you want to work with patients who are going to die? Isn't that hard? But you don't look at it that way.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it is hard, and people often ask me, is geriatrics sad because people are dying? And I think, you know, it is sad to lose a patient. It's not that that isn't difficult, but it's that there's enormous rewards in being able to help patients and their families navigate this difficult journey, you know, the transition at the end of their lives, and figuring out what means the most to them and how we can help them make medical decisions to have the best life that they can and the best quality they can in the time they have left.
And they're also living much longer, I mean, into their 100s. I guess I'm wondering if there's a limit or a lack of scientific understanding of how older people absorb drugs, for instance, or deal with postoperative surgery, or deal with, you know, complex drug interactions. Do we know scientifically about the elderly body as much as we know about the, 40-year-old?
No, we certainly don't, and I think that's another thing that makes geriatrics such an interesting field right now is there's so many opportunities for research and figuring out the best ways to care for older adults. Many of our research trials currently don't go into older age, and so we don't know if this medicine is the right medicine for a 90-year-old as it is for a 40-year-old, for instance, or more importantly, how all of these complex conditions work together and how the multiple medications that someone might need affects a body of a person who's nearing 100.
And it's really no accident. You talk about how you were inspired by role models that you met who practice medicine, taking care of the elderly. What was it about them that made you say, this is the kind of doctor that I want to be?
I think the geriatricians that I've had the opportunity to work with and see practice really have the best balance of, to me, what it means to be a doctor, which is the balance of thinking about the interesting scientific medical puzzle, but also doing what it means to be a doctor, which is to sit with people, talk with them, help the patient and their family understand how the goals and medical options match up, as I mentioned before. And I think the doctors that I've had the opportunity to see do this in incredibly rich and interesting ways. And I thought, well, that's the kind of doctor I hope to be. And if geriatrics is the way to be that kind of doctor, then that seems like the best match for
me. That's very admirable, Dr. Colburn. I'm wondering if you're taking an economic sacrifice, though, in that older Americans are confined to Medicare reimbursement in large part for the kinds of funds and revenues that you would receive in your practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. The data would tell us that geriatricians and general internists and primary care doctors in general, but certainly in geriatrics, make less money than my colleagues who've chosen other specialties out of internal medicine. Often more procedure-based specialties are reimbursed differently, as you mentioned. And so I think there will be an economic sacrifice in part. I hope that over time the reimbursement will change to recognize the complexity that it is to take care of someone with all these conditions and to focus on their goals as all of us get older. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I think for me this is what it means to be a doctor. And so I hope that the reimbursement will change, but it's more important to me that I love what I do every day.
Dr. Jessica Colburn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Jessica Colburn is chief resident at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center, and she will be starting her geriatrics fellowship next year.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Now we have the headlines from Femi Oke. Femi.
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. Tropical storm Dolly is slowly moving further inland over Texas, and in spite of 60-mile-an-hour winds, a tropical storm warning along the coast will likely be lifted later on this morning. Afghan and NATO-led forces are trying to retake a remote town southwest of Kabul. It's been held by the Taliban since Sunday. And just 2 weeks before the Olympics, U.S. swimmer Jessica Hardy is said to have tested positive for a banned stimulant. I just want to go over to Berlin. I've been talking to my BBC colleagues there who are covering the visit of Senator Barack Obama. I've checked in with my colleagues. Senator Obama has already met with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He's now taking some photo calls. He's coming up with a meeting with the mayor of Berlin. Right now he's talking to some youngsters. He's actually creating an awful lot of buzz in Germany, and the people out on the streets are very keen to meet him.
I think Obama will bring a new change, a new kind of politics to America.
Obama, I think, is a man who tries to move something. And that is why people here in Germany say, well, that could be the man for the USA and for the whole world.
So the Germans are in the tank with Obama. I think that's clear.
There was a survey that said that 3/4 of Germans want Obama to be the next U.S. president.
Wow.
We have more from Berlin.
I wonder what American voters are thinking.
That's the question. I wish I knew. I put money on it.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning. I'm Adore Udoji, and it is not a disco. This is The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. This is the techno takeaway. And the city that Barack Obama will be visiting is in fact visiting today. Berlin is a very different city than JFK visited when he gave his famous speech near the Brandenburg Gates. Barack Obama is visiting a city that has much changed. And some of the sound that you're listening to there is from Love Parade, which is one of Berlin's contemporary claims to fame. It is the home of the largest street party in the universe. It's actually not held in Berlin anymore because it got so huge back in 2003. But joining us now is Bjorn Cullen, who's a spokesperson for the Love Parade and a resident of the modern Berlin. Bjorn, du bist ein Berliner, jetzt? Ja?
Yeah, that's great. Kind of.
Thanks for joining us. Kind of. Describe the Berlin of today. When you think Berlin, what do you think?
I think of a very open city where you can do what you want, where you can dress how you like, and there are no restrictions. Really liberal and free.
And how is that different from Amsterdam, which everyone sort of describes as kind of a crazy sort of hedonistic party? Berlin is a little bit different than that.
Yeah, of course. In a way, you've got two cities, which are one now, but they grew together. You've got different mentalities, the former eastern part, the former western part. So it's a kind of a melting pot.
A European melting pot in addition to a German melting pot, right?
Yeah, European melting pot, but still also a German melting pot, because you have the mentality of the former eastern part, and they grow together.
What explains this love parade that Barack Obama is going to be getting today?
You mean what he's doing today?
Well, just why people in Germany seem so very, very passionate about this candidate for the American presidency.
I think, it's connected to hope, because everybody is very critical about George W. Bush. And Barack Obama seems to be a new hope for a different style of foreign policy, although I'm quite sure that Germans are critical about it, but because they know America, and you know, it's the president of the United States. He's got duties. He's got the corporate world behind him. But still, Obama seems a big hope of change.
So, is it about symbolism? Does he represent, many believe there in Germany, this notion of modern Germany, modern Berliners?
Yeah, probably in a way, because he's a black president, and maybe it all
not president yet, but almost.
No,
perhaps.
That's true, a candidate. But maybe because he's black, and seems to be like a new development, because he would be the first black president, and yeah, I think there's a lot of hope connected to it that he's from a different background.
Is it hope for America or hope for Germany? I mean, it's not likely we're going to see a Turkish ethnicity president of Germany, for instance, anytime soon, standing up at the Brandenburg Gates.
Well, that's a really global question. Probably hope for both. I mean, I think Germans are still critical about it. It's not like they say, oh, he's the saint and everything will be all right after that. But still, it seems to be a different direction and not the hawkish kind of way. And that's what people are looking forward to.
So Barack Obama is getting a great reception in Berlin. But if Americans were to visit Berlin, just generally, American tourists, I mean, are we sort of ugly folks, or is there more of a welcoming sense in the Bush era? You're certainly very critical of our president.
Very welcoming, very welcome. I've got friends from America, and I became to know them in Berlin, and there are quite a lot of Americans, and it's a really nice city to meet people, and people are really open-minded, friendly. So it's not at all about the people in America. It's about the politics.
Do you have any tattoos there, Bjorn?
No.
No. Any body piercings?
No.
You got a mohawk?
No, I'm actually looking quite the normal kind of guy.
Quite the normal kind of guy. And you are the spokesperson for the Love Parade itself, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And why do Berliners and Germans generally and Europeans participate in this event?
It's the biggest party in the world, and I think its origin was in Berlin, and it's in Germany, and it's still a very unique party. You don't have it anywhere else in the world, and that's why people go to this original party and travel to Germany, and yeah, they want to be a part of that.
Well, it sounds like fun. I actually would like to leave the studio now and come join the party, but we have to go. Bjorn Cullen, thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bjorn Cullen is spokesperson for the Love Parade. Talking about being in the tank with Barack Obama, you had something to say.
I think 75% of the media being in Barack Obama's court is a fair assessment. The man is getting a free ride. It's like butter on toast, and it's sickening. Every time he actually does get a little bit of hard scrutiny, his campaign cries foul, and his supporters are saying, oh, it's only because he's black. Give me a break. Give this man some true spotlight, because he is not that good.
Man, the Germans are making that hard for the media these days. But a great response, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you can join our conversation. Who's in the tank with Barack Obama? Now it's time for headlines with Femi Okeh, who we hope is not in the tank for Barack Obama. Femi?
No. I'm completely independent in my own tank. Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the hour. A 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck northern Japan this morning. It injured more than 100 people and destroyed more than 30 buildings. The U.S. is pushing North Korea hard to agree to a protocol for verifying that it's dismantling its nuclear arms program. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, says that the ball is in the North's court. Barack Obama is in Germany right now, but he started his day in Israel, where he made a surprise visit to the Western Wall before daybreak. And as is the custom, he left a small note into a small crevice in the wall. I will bring you almost minute-by-minute accounts of how the Senator Obama's trip is going in Germany over the next couple of minutes or so. Bad weather has delayed John McCain's scheduled a trip to New Orleans. He's in Ohio today and is holding a town hall meeting with Lance Armstrong this evening in Columbus. And a House
Are you going to give us minute-to-minute updates on that trip as well?
I can do that.
You better.
Yeah,
I can
do that.
Or else you're in the tank.
Yeah, I would be in the tank. That's and right. I said I was in my own tank. That's right. I was an independent,
there
which
we
I
go.
Am.
All right, you're just trying to explain it. It for our audience.
I will do it. You'll
Let's
be sorry you asked.
Let's keep moving.
But we will have it.
Let's keep moving.
The House Rescue Bill was passed by Congress yesterday. It's expected to be passed by the Senate next week. The vote was 275 to 152, showing that Congress was really in support of hard-strapped homeowners who need a bailout. Some of the details in that House Rescue Bill, it includes $15 billion in house tax breaks, including a credit of up to $7,500 for first-time buyers who buy their homes between April the 9th, 2008, and July the 1st, 2009. And that's
great
a look
stuff.
At your news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
This month, the FBI turns 100, and what a long, strange trip it's been with our beloved G-Men.
1949 marks the 25th anniversary of the FBI as it exists today. Like many another success story, this one had humble beginnings.
Yes, the FBI began during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, but as the narrator said, the Bureau was reborn under J. Edgar Hoover, who became director in 1924. Hoover's agency was one of the most powerful in the U.S. government, and Hoover feared by Congress and presidents alike. Hoover mobilized Hollywood to make heroes out of FBI agents.
This is the story, the fantastically true story of Herbert A. Philbrick, who for 9 frightening years did lead 3 lives. Average citizen, high-level member of the Communist Party, and counter-spy for the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
The FBI. A Quinn Martin Warner Brothers production. Starring Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.
Merging themes of organized crime and the Cold War, that first TV show was I Led 3 Lives from the 1950s, the second, The FBI from the 1960s. But by the 1990s, following the passing of J. Edgar Hoover and the Watergate days of Richard Nixon, the whole FBI image had changed. Remember Agent Clarice Starling from Silence of the Lambs? Well, Hannibal Lecter does.
I couldn't help noticing on the FBI's rather dull public website that I have been elevated to the more prestigious 10 most wanted list. Is this coincidence? Are you back on the case? If so, goody goody.
Goody goody. By the way, the idea for the FBI's 10 most wanted list came in 1949 after a newspaperman asked J. Edgar Hoover to list the toughest guys at large. Generated a lot of attention, and Hoover institutionalized the 10 Most Wanted program. Today, Whitey Bulger and Osama bin Laden topped the roster. Another little detail, in the 1920s, there were only 3 female special agents, and today, there are nearly 2,000.
When the FBI needs an undercover agent,
it's the Miss United States pageant.
The only man for the job is a woman.
You do a few butt-shaping exercises, you tighten this up, you could pull this off.
These people want to put one of their agents in the pageant.
Get ready for the new face of the FBI, Miss Congeniality.
Since J. Edgar Hoover, many new faces for the FBI. And outside of Hollywood, the biggest change perhaps for the image of the agency was 9/11, when it came in for criticism that it was ill-equipped to deal with modern terrorism. Here's terrorism expert Richard Clark testifying before the 9/11 Commission.
The FBI culture, the FBI organization, the FBI personnel are not the best we could do in this country for a domestic intelligence service.
Who knows where the FBI will be 100 years from today, but we know where to find them tomorrow. The paranormal-seeking FBI agents Scully and Mulder return to the silver screen in the film X-Files, I Want to Believe.
I called you in because I valued your belief in this phenomenon. I'm not the most popular girl at the FBI right now.
Scully?
Mulder?
So
from G-Men to investigating the paranormal with 9/11 in the middle, what a long, strange trip
it's been.
It's
a very large umbrella.
That's great.
And it still exists today.
And a cultural theme that's very deep into our notion of America. American law enforcement is inseparable from the FBI. Happy birthday, FBI. And to you, J. Edgar, wherever you are.
Good morning. Femi Okeh has just joined us with the latest headlines. Femi.
Hello there. It is 12 minutes to the hour. A house rescue bill will move swiftly through Congress and will help 400,000 homeowners with their mortgages. President Bush has said he will sign it. Bill Gates and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg are joining forces to spend $500 million to stop people around the world from smoking. A new report by the U.S. Geological Survey finds the Arctic has just over a fifth of the world's oil and natural gas resources, enough to meet current world demand for almost 3 years. DNA tests in Guatemala have proven for the first time that a child put up for adoption in the state system had been stolen. And Senator Obama is visiting Berlin. He's due to appear on live German TV tonight, which makes it midday our time approximately on the East Coast. And in the interest of fair and balanced news coverage, as John was insisting that I do, John McCain is in Ohio. Now, he was supposed to head to Louisiana, but bad weather in that part of the country stopped the trip. So he's having a fundraiser this afternoon, 4:30 p.m., I believe. And this evening, he's hosting a healthcare town hall meeting with Mr. Lance Armstrong.
Is the liberal media responsible for the bad weather?
Do you know? I don't believe
All right,
so.
Well, let's get
no,
on
I
that,
think
please.
That's an act of God.
Let's definitely get on that.
But the weather is actually getting better.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
As Femi said, Barack Obama is in Germany today, where he's already met with Chancellor Angela Merkel. They were scheduled to talk about NATO relations, climate change, among other international hot topics. And John McCain, as Femi said, well, John McCain is in Ohio, where he's talking to voters. And this week, he's been taking shots at the media, at least in video.
What percentage of the mainstream media is in the tank for Barack Obama?
Oh, by 90%.
Joining us now to talk about the state of McCain's counterattack to Obama's blitz in Europe and the Middle East is Jonathan Martin, who covers the Republicans for Politico.com. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with that Media Loves Obama video. I mean, what's the goal here? Is it satire? Is the McCain campaign being serious? Are they trying to rev up their base?
I think it's a little bit of that, what you mentioned, satire, trying to rev up the base, and it's also a third thing. In sports, they call it working the refs, and that is that, you know, essentially you're trying to extract a little bit of guilt, and you're trying to, you know, get the next call your way, if you will. And I think that this is about doing something akin to what Saturday Night Live did earlier this spring in the Obama-Clinton race, and that is to shame some of the media into perhaps offering some tougher scrutiny of Obama. And that's the goal here. That said, a little bit risky because obviously McCain now is being pressed in every interview. Do you think the media is biased against you? And of course, McCain, not wanting to look peevish and small, says, no, you know, it is what it is, and I'm very happy. But obviously, when his campaign is putting out this video claiming that we're all in love, it sends a very different signal.
And it certainly is a terrific turn of events because not that many months ago, McCain was thought of as the darling of the media in that the media wasn't going after McCain on some of his statements, wasn't taking a look at his history in the Senate. And so now for him to be spending so much time when there's so many other issues on the campaign this week makes him look rather defensive, doesn't it?
Well, the joke is, well, John McCain would know from good media coverage, right? This is somebody who his fellow Republicans have complained for years that he gets great coverage oftentimes at their expense. And in fact, I had a former staffer for Mitt Romney sort of roll his eyes to me when McCain put out this video saying, oh my goodness, you know, this is somebody who got this fantastic treatment against us in the primary. And really going back to 1999, mm-hmm. when McCain first started running for president, he just got incredible coverage is somebody who has long relied upon the media. And especially, you know, when his campaign was sort of down and out last year, he didn't have a lot of money. He really was helped in a huge way by the media, which, as we know, loves a good comeback story. So it is a bit audacious of him.
Let's talk about the substance of what McCain's been talking about. All week he's been very critical of Obama's foreign policy positions, especially on the U.S. troop surge in Iraq. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
He was wrong then, he's wrong now, and he still fails to acknowledge... He still fails to acknowledge that the surge succeeded.
Do you think this is an effective strategy, given the complexities of the issue as to the surge success and whether or not that helped aid the Iraqis in taking some of the security issues into their own hands? And are voters paying any attention if conventional wisdom is the rule? Generally, they don't start paying attention until sometime after Labor Day.
Well, he's in a very tough spot. They've got to find some kind of a wedge here against Obama when it comes to Iraq at this point, and there's really only one clear sort of shot, and that is that he was against a surge, which most folks believe now was successful in reducing the violence. The problem, and Tom Friedman wrote about this in the Times yesterday, and others have too, the problem with that is that, yeah, the surge did work, and that has changed the sort of narrative in Iraq and put it right now on Obama's turf, and that is the question looming there is not whether or not the surge was successful. It's about, okay, it was, so now when are we going to bring
now
the troops
what?
Home?
Right,
and
now
so,
what?
Jonathan, you know, you say narrative, and that's kind of annoying to me, but here's why. It seems to me that the media chooses narratives to cover Barack Obama and John McCain. John McCain has a powerful narrative story of his, you know, fight back from being a prisoner of war. And Barack Obama, of course, has a towering kind of narrative. If your strategy for covering these characters is choosing these narratives, you know, whether they're in Iraq or not, you know, you're gonna suddenly be stuck with the fact that, hey, you know, Barack Obama has a bigger narrative, so he has a bigger tank. Everyone's in the tank with both of these candidates. It's just Obama has a bigger tank.
Yeah, well, let me just recant that. When I said narrative, that was probably a poor choice of words.
But some might say Freudian.
Yeah, what I was referring to was exactly, you know, what is the sort of dominant element right now in Iraq as far as the U.S. troop presence there? I guess narrative isn't the best word. But
well, forget about Iraq for a moment. Address the issue of these two narratives. One is bigger than the other, period. If that's your choice, covering narratives of these candidates, Barack Obama is always going to be favored.
No, of course. I totally agree with that. But the American people also have a say in this thing, and they don't really care who has the bigger narrative, and they're going to vote for who they want to be president. Are they influenced by the media? Of course they are. But look, if this thing was only about who's got the bigger narrative, Barack Obama would be up 20 points by now on the polls, and he's not. He was supposed to be enjoying a much larger balance after winning that primary, and this is still a darn close horse race. And every real poll that I've seen has it within sort of 5-6 points in a terrible year for Republicans. So this is still a very, very competitive race. And even if the media is purportedly in the tank for Obama, the American voters are still hesitant about them, as demonstrated by these polls.
Jonathan, a very quick question, because we only have a few seconds. Just to ask you about some of what's made a big brouhaha this week, and that is some of the gaffes that McCain has made, referring to Czechoslovakia, a country that no longer exists, referring to the Iraq-Afghanistan border, which doesn't exist, thinking perhaps he meant Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Media making too much of those?
Well, you know, by themselves, probably not a big deal. The challenge, as you guys know, is that combined, they do form, I won't say narrative, but they do form a potential problem for McCain in the sense
a potential problem. We're going to have to leave it there. Jonathan Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it, guys.
Jonathan Martin covers the Republicans for Politico.com.
Well, the FBI turns 100 this month. We're taking a look back at a century of bureau lore. A historic trial continues at Guantanamo Bay today. And is the media in the tank with Barack Obama? Our listener Jay doesn't think so.
I'm astonished at this issue about whether or not the press is in favor of Obama. John McCain always called the press his base. He's been treated by the press as if he could do no wrong. Not one single one of his flip-flops, like his flip-flop on taxes, or his flip-flop on waterboarding, none of those make the press.
What do you think? That was a good response. We like all of your responses. Does Barack Obama get special treatment in the media? Senator John McCain is in Ohio today talking to voters. Obama is in Berlin to talk to Germans. And here's your takeaway.
So it's not at all about the people in America. It's about the politics.
That was Berlin Love Parade spokesman Bjorn Cullen, who joined us to talk about Berliners and how they think of Obama.
Today, join us online for two more hours of new material. We're streaming from 7 to 8 and 9 to 10. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
German moths find a new flame.
Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Given the chance, 74% of Germans would vote for Barack Obama. He speaks in Berlin later today. Chancellor Angela Merkel, who came to office with only a 17% margin, has warned Obama against using German landmarks for electioneering. We're guessing the candidate is going to skip the shoulder rub. Travel tips, tough love, it's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 24th, and we're looking at what happens to the media when a candidate is a global phenomenon. The health needs of the aged. It's lonely out there for family caregivers. Annoying nostalgia for the lost age of Starbucks. Huh? What am I talking about? And Pakistan gets a low APR on a financing deal for some fighter jets. Guess what? You're buying. That and all the news. Barack Obama arrived in Berlin today, and he's already met with Chancellor Angela Merkel. Also expected a major speech on U.S.-European relations he'll give to a crowd estimated to be at least 100,000 people. Germany is the first of a three-country tour this week, including Britain and France. Flooding is now the concern as Tropical Storm Dolly moves deeper into southern Texas. Some areas have already gotten up to a foot of rain, and more is expected. The storm still has sustained winds of 60 miles an hour. This man says there was no question Dolly was packing a punch.
I looked through the windows, and I saw the palm trees almost bending halfway. You know, that's how hard it was, the wind.
Tropical storm warning along the coast will likely be lifted later this morning.
A housing rescue plan has passed the House and is expected to quickly pass the Senate. The plan, which will cost billions of dollars, will help homeowners struggling with mortgage payments to obtain new, cheaper loans and tax breaks. The legislation will also provide support for the troubled mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Scott Garrett is a Republican congressman from New Jersey who was among those to vote against the housing package.
You're taking with one hand and you're giving with the other. It's an absurd arrangement we've created.
The bill would also shore up government-packed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as we said. Pakistan wants to upgrade its fighter jets, and the U.S. State Department is trying to help. It's asking Congress to let it use two-thirds of the money proposed for anti-terrorism programs for Pakistan to use to upgrade aging warplanes. That total is $226 million.
12-mile oil spill in the Mississippi River has crews working overtime. We'll have more details on that. In politics, Barack Obama in Germany, as Catherine said, and bad weather has delayed John McCain's scheduled trip to New Orleans. He's in Ohio today. Oil's trading way down, $124 a barrel. The Dow closed at 11,632. The S&P was up 0.5%. Is the media in the tank for Barack Obama? My alternative co-host this morning, Catherine Lamfer.
Adora's on assignment.
That's right, Adora's on assignment. We are asking you, is the media in the tank for Barack Obama, and how do you cover a candidate who is a global phenomenon and attempt to be equal and fair to the other candidate, John McCain, who was also a global phenomenon at one point? At 877-8-MY-TAKE is a way to reach us. MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Back with Catherine in a moment. Good morning, everybody. I'm joined in the studio here in New York by, Air America legend and Minnesota Public Radio star Catherine Lamfer, who's co-hosting today in for Adora Udoji, who's on assignment in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, listen to this, John. People are so excited in Berlin about the Barack Obama speech later today that one city paper there printed instructions on how to make little American flags, the better to wave them at the candidate.
How do they know how to make American flags?
Well, that's why they needed the instructions. So all that infection from the people, they're going to make the stakes higher. American presidential candidates, as you know, usually have to make sure they don't look too cozy, too effete with our European allies. Plus, Obama is also expected to show some tough love to Europeans, telling them they need to do more when it comes to issues like Afghanistan. We're going to get more from Jeff Zeleny. He is covering the Obama campaign for the New York Times, and he joins us now from Berlin. Hey, Jeff, flag waving, all these comparisons to JFK. How can there be anything threatening, challenging, or scary in this picture for the Obama campaign?
Well, when Senator Obama arrived about, some 90 minutes, 2 hours ago in Berlin, we saw sort of what we've been hearing for the last week. There were, you know, scores of people lining the streets. There were cheering fans as he entered his hotel. And he said on his flight here from Jerusalem this morning that he said, look, we need to tamp down expectations for this. He said, we're not going to get a million people. You know, what if I don't build a big crowd? So he is already starting to tamp down expectations. But this is a high-stakes speech, no question about it, because the campaign has built its entire week-long overseas journey around this speech of this evening, and we'll get a preview of it a little bit later on today.
Now, we keep hearing that he has a message of change for Europe. Exactly what kind of change are we talking about?
I think the message of change for Europe is, like you said, he had a meeting this morning with Angela Merkel, and they were expected to discuss Afghanistan. She has said that she is not willing to send more German troops to Afghanistan. He, of course, is calling for more American troops to be sent to Afghanistan. He also, though, will talk about more non-controversial or things that aren't as controversial. He'll talk about climate change, other things. But look for this speech to be as lofty in its rhetoric, perhaps more than specific in its substance. Again, this whole trip for Senator Obama has been designed not to be controversial. So I would not look for a controversial, in-your-face speech, to the Germans or to Europe. He is looking to simply be seen as someone who can rebuild America's image in the world. So he's not coming over to Berlin to deliver a speech that is confrontational in any respect.
How much of his popularity is due to the fact that he's not George Bush?
Well, I think that is a big part of his popularity here. You know, the few people that we've spoken with and my colleagues have spoken to who are lining the streets and things are just simply excited about seeing someone new. They're excited about the change. A lot of the people are young people. Some people are even sort of chanting a slogan, "Yes, we can." But the most important audience for this speech is not necessarily here in Berlin. It's back in the U.S. So the Obama campaign has been very busy sending messages and things, sending photos, sending their whole travelogue, if you will, of this back to supporters and other things. So what they are trying to do is simply show that Senator Obama can appear on the world stage, can look presidential, et cetera. So I wouldn't, you know, we're not going to know how successful this trip was until probably the election, but certainly until it settles back in. Next week, he's going to find himself back in the battleground states of the U.S., he has a tough campaign ahead against Senator McCain.
Well, I suspect you realize, Jeff, that as you're over there touring Europe and the Middle East, that, the punditocracy is consumed with the issue of whether the mainstream media is in some sort of tank with Barack Obama. It must be challenging for you to cover the candidate with any sense of symmetry with John McCain when Barack Obama appears to be such a global phenomenon everywhere you go, and John McCain is just sort of a dude standing around going, "Hey, what about me?"
Well, when John McCain was traveling to the Middle East and to Europe, he received some press coverage, but he did not give any public speeches. He did not draw this type of crowd. So in some respects, it is what it is. During the primary campaign, a lot of supporters of Senator Hillary Clinton said, you know, "Why are you covering the Obama rallies? Why are you writing about the fact that so many people are going?" The fact is, reporters go where the story is, and it's news by any stretch of the matter when a Democratic presidential nominee or a Republican presidential nominee is doing an overseas tour like this. Is the media in love with Senator Obama? Of course, I would say absolutely not. You know, we cover him as objectively as we would Senator McCain. It just happens to be that this is where the story is. And if you look at some of the coverage, some of the specific coverage, I don't think it's been as positive. And I would look for perhaps a bit of a boomerang effect on all of this. I mean, the Obama campaign realizes that
that they have their work cut out for them once they get back home. And Iraq is certainly a complication. So in many respects, this trip has just simply underscored the challenges ahead for the next few months. But, you know, you can't simply ignore the fact that a presidential candidate is doing this in Europe. Is it good? Is it bad? We'll let the voters decide.
All right, Jeff Zeleny, we're going to have to let it end there. We've got other stories to boomerang, too. Thanks for joining us.
Looking for boomerangs in Berlin there, Jeff Zeleny. Thank you. We now are joined by Eric Schmidt, who is also from the New York Times. He's on the line with us from Washington to talk about an interesting development in Washington. The U.S. Bush administration announcing that there's a plan to give serious assistance to the Pakistani military in its attempt to upgrade its fleet of F-16 fighter jets. The question is it some sort of quid pro quo that relates to the war on terror and the troubled U.S. relationship with Pakistan? And what is Congress likely to say about this? Eric Schmidt covers the issue for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Good morning.
First of all, Congress and the administration, or Congress and administrations, are known to get into these battles over, high-level military hardware for countries in conflict zones. How do you think this one is likely to do, and what are the motives for offering this plan to the Pakistanis?
Well, the backdrop to this is last year, the Congress decided to put specific requirements on the $300 million in military aid that the U.S. gives to Pakistan every year. Congress was getting sick and tired of what they thought was a policy that was weighted too heavily toward military and security measures. So what they did was they said, look, any of this aid that you're going to send over there as military aid has to be tied to law enforcement or counterterrorism. And that's what the administration initially did with this money, at least a big chunk of it, about $225 million. They were going to spend it to refurbish some patrol planes, some attack helicopters, things that are proven to work in counterinsurgency. Well, as it turns out, the Pakistanis have had a long-standing desire, as you said, to modernize some of their F-16s. F-16s, however, in the eyes of many in Congress, are not an effective counterinsurgency tool. What they do, however, is help Pakistan gain more parity in its traditional rivalry with India. So you've got the Pakistanis pushing hard to upgrade these aircraft, and the administration trying to make the argument, well, if we make these more up-to-date, they will be able to use them in support of the ground troops that Pakistan is fielding in the rest of tribal areas along the Afghan border.
But anything that relates to the arms race with India, of course, has domestic Pakistani political significance, and it wouldn't be surprising for members of Congress to say this is simply a bit of a sort of political payoff to the new Pakistani prime minister, who the Bush administration doesn't have much of a track record with at this point.
That's right. And this new prime minister will be arriving in Washington next week for talks with President Bush. The administration is increasingly frustrated by the lack of what they see, a lack of effort by the Pakistani security forces to press al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters in the tribal areas. And so many in Congress feel that the timing of this switch of the fundings, the counterterrorism fundings to the F-16s, is a way to curry favor with the prime minister before he visits next week.
Quickly, Eric, regionally, what would be perceived as the threat of Pakistan having F-16s?
Well, there's two things. One is that you have a much more capable attack plane, both an air-to-air fighter, but also a ground attack plane that could be used, of course, in a conventional war with India. There's also the concern that it could be used to deliver nuclear weapons. In the larger struggle, of course, the nuclear test of wills between the two countries, India and Pakistan.
And there's nothing fantasy about that. That is definitely a nuclear frontier, India and Pakistan. Eric Schmidt, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Eric Schmidt is a reporter for the New York Times, speaking to us from Washington on this issue of a $300 million, or close to that, financing plan for upgrading Pakistan's fleet of F-16 fighter jets. Good morning, everybody. You know, if you just stopped what you're doing, dropped what you're doing, and called 877-8-MY-TAKE and answered the question, do you think the mainstream media is in the tank with Barack Obama? What kind of coverage do you think he's getting? You, too, could be on The Takeaway.
I find it astonishing that The New Yorker can actually make a satirical cover about all the vicious things that have been said on Fox News or other outlets criticizing Obama and trying to put poison in people's minds in reference to Obama. And McCain says that the media is being too kind to Obama? Strange.
That strange question is what we're talking about today, and you are responding at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or reach us on the website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But now the perspective of Barack Obama's trip to Germany from people in Germany, from German citizens who are certainly spending a lot of time following his meetings with the government officials in Germany, and a speech later today that's expected to have perhaps as many as 100,000 people in attendance. His speech will be covered live on German television tonight. Joining us from Deutschland itself is Arne Delfs, who's a German politics and economics editor at the Financial Times. Arne, thanks for being with us.
Yes, good morning. Hi from Berlin.
Certainly, Germans there in Berlin are very much focused on the character of Barack Obama, but do they have any concrete sense of what kind of president he might be and how it might be different from George W. Bush?
Well, I think, first of all, like, Germans yearn for a new American face. I mean, you know, George W. Bush is really not liked in Germany very much. And when Bush was here, like a few weeks ago, he was actually hidden away in a small castle outside of Berlin because the government here feared really protests against Bush. And really, in contrast to that, you have like somebody like Obama, who arrives here like a pop star. I mean, he landed here about 4 hours ago. And actually, it might in the end be like around 1 million people coming to the Siegessäule, the victory pole here in Berlin tonight. So that, but answering your question, what he actually stands for, I think there's a rather naive perception here. People think he's better than Bush, but really nobody knows exactly what he's standing for.
So nobody knows, but still he draws a million.
Well, now here's a question for you. I'm wondering what the popularity of Obama, what that says about Germany's own racial and ethnic struggles. I'm thinking, of course, of your large Turkish community, but there are other immigrants as well.
Yes, good question. I think it doesn't play such a big role. First of all, one is, as I said, very happy that it's somebody different than Bush. Obviously, he has charisma, he has rhetorical gifts, he has, compared to other rather pale government, he is a very characterful persona with charisma. I think this racial thing, for example, if you had somebody here, like a person with color, like, say, an Afro-American or an Asian running for German president, I think people would actually have a problem with that. As strangely enough, they don't have it with Obama.
Hmm. You know, let's talk a little bit about the city that Barack Obama is actually visiting
mm-hmm.
today.
Yeah.
I mean, oddly, the place that John F. Kennedy visited back in 1963 doesn't exist anymore. I mean, there is no Berlin Wall. There's no East and West. The idea of being a Berliner and being some sort of symbol of freedom in the midst of the Cold War is completely outmoded. Yet, Berliners apparently still think of their city as a kind of global symbol. A symbol of what?
I think not only Berliners, obviously, but also the Obama campaigners, because they really wanted his speech to be held in front of the Brandenburg Gate, which is, of course, a symbol for the division, but then also for German reunification. And, of course, that is the same image also for Berliners. I mean, this Brandenburg Gate is just a very powerful symbol. And, you know, the story, I mean, the German chancellor actually was against Obama's wish to give a speech there. Now he's moving a few hundred meters further back near the Siegessäule, where actually normally the so-called this love parade takes place. You know, this big music event.
Yes,
here.
No, it's the biggest party in the world, biggest street party in the world.
Yes.
So that's the reputation. Well, you know, at the very least, Arne, you Germans are making it very difficult for the American media to be even-handed in its coverage of the political candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's impossible to be even-handed about John McCain and Barack Obama when a million show up for Barack Obama and maybe, you know, 30 show up for John McCain?
Well, 30 is a lot, but maybe...
30 is a lot.
Actually, to tell you the truth, I think most people don't even know McCain. I mean, which I'm sure, you know, we do him injustice because I'm sure he has some good ideas and he's not George W. Bush, which is fine.
Which is the best thing going for him, best thing anyone has going. I'm not George W. Bush either. I wonder if I could get a million people to show up for me. Arne Delps is a German politics and economics editor at the Financial Times. Thanks for joining us from Berlin.
Okay, thank you.
Now it's time for... Could you draw a million if you're not George W. Bush, Catherine?
Well, apparently I could. I also like the way that Arne, when
nobody
you
knows
said
anything about you.
That you're making it hard for fair coverage, he did not sound very concerned.
No, he didn't sound concerned.
But speaking of fair coverage, let's turn now to Femi Oke and the latest news.
Good morning. No pressure. 28 minutes past the hour. Tropical storm Dolly is slowly moving further inland over Texas. It's expected to be downgraded in the next few hours once it's left the oceans. It actually dies down somewhat, so just more rain, unfortunately, in the forecast for you. The Bush administration plans to shift nearly $230 million in aid to Pakistan from counterterrorism programs to upgrading that country's aging F-16 attack planes. And just 2 weeks before the Olympics, 21-year-old U.S. swimmer Jessica Hardy is said to have tested positive for a banned stimulant. Congress is reviewing the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy for the first time since its enactment 15 years ago. Now, as we've just heard, Barack Obama is in Berlin for the European leg of his international tour this morning. Now, I've just been checking in with my BBC colleagues. They tell me that he's on pretty much every front page in their office, and he's about to meet the mayor of Berlin. It's expected to have huge, huge crowds there, and we've already begun to see some of the enthusiasm from the crowds in Berlin.
I think Obama will bring a new change, a new kind of politics to America.
Obama, I think, is a man who tries to move something, and that is why people here in Germany say, well, that could be the man for the USA and for the whole world.
Those are some of the voices from Germany excited about seeing Senator Obama. There's a survey in Germany that says that three quarters of Germans want Senator Obama to be the next U.S. president.
That report from the Obama tank and our own Femi. Okay, thank you, Femi.
I told you. I'm in my own tank.
Deep in the tank.
How am I in the tank?
Oh, tell us about your tank.
I'm just reporting what's out there.
Yeah, you and Jeff Zeleny. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Catherine Lanford, sitting in for Adore Udoji. She is off on assignment. Writer Jane Gross has been reporting on the elderly and aging for 4 years now, but it was her experience caring for her late mother that forms the emotional foundation of a new blog she's doing for the New York Times called The New Old Age. Just because we're living longer doesn't mean we're living better, but there are steps you can take, whether you're taking care of family members or looking ahead for yourself. And we got Jane up pretty early, and we know she's taking care of herself. She's had some tea now, and she joins us by phone. Hey, Jane.
Hi, good morning, and forgive my voice.
It's quite all right. Now, you have the benefit now of 20/20 hindsight in taking care of your mother through the end of her life. What didn't you know that you want to make sure others know now?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know a lot of things. I think the most basic thing I didn't know is that Medicare and, you know, the other medical insurance programs that you think cover this kind of stuff don't.
Take another big gulp of tea there.
I like your voice, Jane. You obviously were at the Yankee game yesterday where I was screaming for Mike Messina. That's
it's
clear.
It's a little bit embarrassing. Forgive me.
I was taking Brenda Vaccaro myself, not a sports analogy. Now, Jane, what is new about growing old?
First, that there are so many more people living, you know, into their late 80s, 90s, and longer, because they're not dying of the things that they used to die of. And if they live that long without, you know, dying of the more ordinary things, often old age is less for a very long time. You're either cognitively impaired or physically very frail, as opposed to being sick with, you know, a sort of frank disease that can be treated in some kind of way. And, you know, it's sort of the wheels are falling off the bicycle. I think what we would historically call dying of old age as opposed to dying of something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the infrastructure for this, which you talk about in your blog in a lot of detail, has been eroding for quite some time. I mean, one or two generations ago, this was the kind of thing that the extended family dealt with, perhaps not in the best possible way, but certainly to a greater extent than we're able to do it today, where everyone's an individual, everyone's living in their own home, and, you know, extended families may exist, but only on the telephone. How lonely is it to be a caregiver in this era compared with what it must have been like two generations ago?
Oh, well, I mean, it's hugely lonely. I mean, in my family, it was me and my younger brother, period. You know, your point about the difference in families is very well taken, because not only are they scattered, but the women who would ordinarily and, you know, in many ways still carry the weight of this are working.
Right.
You know, going to that isolation factor you were talking about, John, Jane's blog, it isn't very old. And you already have people complaining about how there's too much personal venting about the woes of taking care of elderly parents. And I'm wondering, you know, what that says about the need for people to just have a place to talk about this.
Well, actually, the day after that venting complaint, I guess it was yesterday, there were many comments from people talking exactly about what you're talking about, which is that the venting reflects how lonely it is. It also is something that doesn't exactly enliven a cocktail party if this is what you're doing and this is what sort of pops out of your mouth in conversation. The only people who really want to listen to you are people who are going through it at the same time.
Now, Jane, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to ask you, what was your biggest takeaway after caring for your mother? What did you walk away with?
Well, I was extremely fortunate in that my mother and I wound up much, much closer than we were beforehand. My brother and I wound up much closer than we were beforehand. So, I mean, there was a great deal of sort of reconciliation in my family, which was wonderful.
Jane, I want to thank you for your time.
Tea and honey now, Jane.
Yes.
Take care of yourself.
Yes, indeed.
All right, the blog is The New Old Age, and now we turn to...
Well, hold on 1 second. You know,
yes, sir.
Femi's right here. But,
right.
You know, that reminds me of a quote of a dear family friend of ours who had, like, 13 siblings. And she said when her mother died, that she always thought of herself as a member of a big family until she had to care for her mother and she discovered she was an only child because the rest of the family didn't want anything to do with the care of an elderly parent. It's such a lonely, passionate, emotional experience.
Which is how I think about Femi reading the news.
What a segue. Thanks, Fem. Welcome.
You're very welcome. Thank you. 21 minutes to the hour. A 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck northern Japan this morning. It injured more than 100 people. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says it's up to North Korea to establish a protocol for verifying that it's dismantling its nuclear arms program. Barack Obama's in Germany, and he received a very friendly greeting by Chancellor Angela Merkel. He heads to Paris and London tomorrow. And John McCain was supposed to deliver a speech from an oil rig off the coast of New Orleans today, but bad weather from Hurricane Dolly, as it was, and an oil spill that's close to a stretch of the Mississippi means he's staying in Ohio. He holds a town hall meeting in Columbus later. Now, let's just get back to Dolly. Right now, it is a tropical storm, so the wind speeds are dropping. But when it made landfall in Texas, wind speeds are up to 100 miles an hour. Some of the damage that we've seen so far, buildings have been destroyed, the roofs of buildings have been destroyed due to those 100 mile an hour winds. And we still are expecting quite a bit of rainfall, up to about 12 inches in the next 24 hours, maybe even 20 inches in some isolated spots just along the coastline of Texas. We are still seeing tropical storm warnings. We're expecting those to actually die down in the next couple of hours or so. And
Tropical Storm Dolly is moving about 7 miles an hour, which is very slow, so it just gives it even more opportunity to dump tons and tons of rain.
So the storm is moving slowly, but the high winds and lots of rain.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Who's in the tank with Barack Obama? Are the mainstream media expressing a certain amount of asymmetry in their coverage? Here's what you had to say.
I think 75% of the media being in Barack Obama's court is a fair assessment. The man that's getting a free ride is like butter on toast, and it's sickening. Every time he actually does get a little bit of hard scrutiny, his campaign cries foul, and his supporters are saying, oh, it's only because he's black. Give me a break. Give this man some true spotlight, because he is not that good.
Definitely media is in favor of Obama, and you can tell by the number of coverage, the New York Times refused an article. It's definitely in favor of Obama.
877-8-MY-TAKE. Reach us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Catherine Lanford, in for Adore Udoji, who's on assignment.
Catherine, you know, remember back to the mid-90s. Can you do that for me?
Hang on.
Back then, those were the days you could get your coffee fixed from wherever you wanted, because Starbucks, remember back then, was everywhere.
Can I help you?
I'd like to get my ear pierced.
Well, better make it quick, kiddo. In 5 minutes, this place is becoming a Starbucks.
Of course, The Simpsons, talking about Starbucks being worked well into the culture. Just a few weeks ago, the company announced it would be closing hundreds of stores across the nation. Of course, Starbucks is still around. Big deal, you might say. But there's already a nostalgia for what Starbucks created. Phil Vitale's a restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. Phil, not only are people in Chicago worried and disappointed, they're trying to campaign, save our Starbucks. What's that all about, Phil?
There is a national campaign called Save Our Starbucks. They have a website and everything, which is simply saveourstarbucks.com. And they are, for some areas, they think the loss of a Starbucks is a very bad thing, and they're trying to persuade the company to rethink some of these decisions.
Now, hang on a minute. I thought that, you know, indie coffee stores everywhere, I thought they were the ones with websites. Why do we need to save a Starbucks?
Well, that's a good point, but in some areas, there aren't a lot of indie coffee spots, and for some areas, a Starbucks means jobs and opportunities that previously didn't exist.
And you're right, Phil, to pay $7 or $10 or even $12 for a cup of coffee. Gosh darn it.
That's right. Well, you know, people can spend what they want, but In the case I was talking about on my blog, in which they were talking about closing a couple of underperforming stores, but these were in neighborhoods that have been underserved by national chains in general and by coffee chains in particular, and they were, some people there were very, very, very upset. They think these stores might be closing, and I thought, well, if you want to petition the company and to keep it open and maybe tell them that one of the reasons you buy their coffee is because they have this national image as good guys, people who care about the environment, people who care about people, and you could maybe persuade them that your willingness to buy a $7 latte on Michigan Avenue was partially tied into the fact that they would keep open a store on Stony Island Boulevard.
Right. Well,
maybe they would readjust their calculus a bit.
Now, maybe this is bigger than Starbucks, though. Maybe this is all about the creation by a lot of companies, Barnes & Noble among them, Starbucks, and a lot of independent places, of this kind of private sector public space, these sort of parks inside commercial spaces that people really, really love. They may not be revenue producers, but people don't want them to go away.
Exactly. That was the whole Starbucks desire when they created this brand, when they created this chain, to turn these stores into places where people gathered, to make them, as you said, even almost public parks. And so once you persuade people in that mind that Starbucks is more than just a shop for coffee, it's a store where people pull up their laptops or they gather or they meet at Starbucks and talk, then losing one is more than simply a dollars and cents decision. Hmm.
Well, Phil Vitale very, very persuasively making the case that Starbucks has created a bit of a national park monster with its public spaces, and attempting to roll them back has produced an outrage. Phil Vitale's a restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
My pleasure.
People in Chicago are disappointed. Maybe they should go back to Cheeseburger, Cheeseburger, Cheeseburger.
Ah, the Billy Goat Tavern.
Good question, who's in the tank with Barack Obama? Are the media? Answer us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, headlines from Femi Okeng.
Hello there. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, a housing rescue plan now moving swiftly through Congress will help 400,000 homeowners with their mortgages. President Bush has said he'll sign it. Bill Gates and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg are joining forces to spend $500 million to stop people around the world from smoking. A new report by the U.S. Geological Survey finds that the Arctic has just over a fifth of the world's oil and natural gas resources, enough to meet current world demand for almost 3 years. DNA tests in Guatemala have proven for the first time that a child put out for adoption in the state system had been stolen. And John McCain is in Ohio today. He was supposed to head to Louisiana, but the bad weather in that part of the country stopped the trip. So he's having a fundraiser this afternoon, and this evening he's hosting a healthcare town hall meeting with Lance Armstrong. And I have no idea where Senator Obama is today. No clue. That's a look at your news.
That's a totally pro-McCain.
I think I'm going to single woman address the balance here.
Whoa. How big is that tank that you're in with McCain? Is it a big tank? Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for Adore Udoji, who is on vacation. Now, John, call it the X chromosome files.
Are you familiar with the so-called X files?
I believe they have to do with unexplained phenomena.
More or less. The reason you're here, Agent Scully, is we want you to assist Mulder on these X-Files.
Thanks, Scully. Hey, you want unexplained phenomena? Why is there such a dearth of strong female pop culture characters on the big screen this summer? Well, we've got Rebecca Traister from Salon.com. She's joining us here in the studio to tell us that relief is on the way this weekend with the X-Files movie I Want to Believe, featuring none other than Agent Dana Scully. Rebecca?
Hi, Catherine.
Full disclosure, just how much of an X-Files geek were you when the series was on TV?
I was a big X-Files geek.
Tell me you didn't name your dog after one of the characters.
I managed to avoid naming my dog Skinner, but, you know, by a hair, really.
Yeah, okay. Hey, here's a fun fact. I just found this out today. Pamela Anderson was originally considered to play Dana Scully.
Is that true?
Hey, it's on the internet. How could it not be true?
I don't think I would have been writing my ode to Agent Scully had she been played by Pamela Anderson. It's just a guess. I don't know.
What sort of landscape for strong female characters do we have this summer on the big screen?
Oh, it's pretty grim, I think. I mean, there are the I know, it's a shock, isn't it? There are the boy movies. There's The Dark Knight and Hellboy and Iron Man.
You feeling left out, John? I'm sorry.
Is this going to be some kind of estrogen rave over women in the movies?
Should we let him into the estrogen halo? I think we should. No, come on. Come in into the estrogen halo. We welcome you. Please, come in.
I think the Hulk has an inner woman. I think. I feel his inner.
If you make a hormone joke, I am leaving the studio.
I already did.
Yeah, okay.
I'm way ahead of you, girl.
Well, the joke is that the girls' movie this summer was Sex and the City,
right,
which was also borrowed from television. That's pretty depressing. When Hollywood has to borrow from the small screen in order to find any decent women to put on the big screen.
Yeah, but you know, I have this image. Somehow I have the feeling that you were not sitting there at midnight with a Cosmos in your thermos waiting for the big showing.
I can't imagine why you get that impression. No, it's true. I was not a Sex and the City person, but I appreciate the fact that there are a lot of people out there who were and for whom.
Oh, come on. How namby-pamby. I appreciate the fact.
No, it's true. Well, at least it was a show about women. I mean, with women as the central characters. I have criticisms of Sex and the City, and in fact, one of the reasons I celebrate Scully is because she's not about Cosmos.
Right, well, let's talk
and
about
heels.
Scully. What are the Scully qualities? I mean, I think of the Avengers. I think of
she might be too young for that.
No, I know the Avengers.
Diana Rigg.
Diana Rigg.
Sure. What is the quality of Scully that you love?
Well, she's complicated. She's tough. She's smart. She's geeky. She's not all about her sex appeal, though that certainly anybody who ever watched The X-Files knows that sexual tension and sex appeal was a huge part of it. But that was not what defined her. She was allowed to ask complicated questions about religion and the kind of science fiction stuff that they were talking about the limits of belief. She was in fact, asked to grow in every episode because she was cast quite frankly, in an initially thankless role as the skeptic, as the schoolmarm who was there to put a damper on wild, crazy Fox Mulder. But in fact, that
we never see that in pop culture, do we?
Oh, no, never.
No, yeah.
But in her being allowed, in fact, by being given such a thankless role, I think she was allowed to become a much more interesting character.
Well, you make a great point about sexual tension and geekness. I mean, there is sexual tension in geekness because they aren't getting any. I mean, there's nothing worse than Sex and the City, where these people are always like, they've got 10 dates.
Right.
They got to take showers in the morning. You know what I mean?
There's no
end. Not like geeks.
You're kicked out of the estrogen halo.
There's no anticipation when everybody's having sex.
I mean,
that's the sexy thing about sexual tension. That's something that, you know, movies of the 1940s understood, and probably because of the code.
Lauren Bacall.
Exactly.
Scully of an earlier era, maybe?
I actually think that that's not a bad comparison. They're both sort of that smoldering, you know,
smart.
I think
we need to emphasize here.
They're smart.
Smart.
Yes.
When smart gets to be sexy, it's a good thing.
Yes. Well, Scully was both smart and sexy. I mean, she would geek out in every episode. She would drop medical terminology, scientific terminology. She was always the one who said, oh, I have to go home and, you know, work on my monograph for the, you know, for whatever medical journal she was working on.
Why is it that we have a dearth of these characters on the big screen, but when you look at the small screen, I mean, how many feature articles have there been about the fact that we have Kira Sedgwick in The Closer,
right,
and Holly Hunter in Grace?
Right.
All these
and
cable
Mary Louise
heroes.
Parker and Glenn Close and all of these women who in many ways, in those cases, have aged out of Hollywood. There aren't good parts for any women over 35 in today's Hollywood. And so what do they have? They have increasingly cinematic television on cable where they can have tough, complicated characters, and people apparently don't seem to mind that they might be over the age of 43 or something.
Halle Berry in X-Men? Does that count?
Is
that a counterexample?
I don't know. I mean, it counts in that she was in the movie. Jessica Alba was in the Fantastic Four.
Right.
But I do think that...
Not smart, though.
Not smart.
And a cartoon character.
Cartoon characters. And there's a significant thing that happens, I think, with somebody like Agent Scully, played by Gillian Anderson, which is that a really terrific actress was made, convinced us that she was absolutely gorgeous. With somebody like Halle Berry or Jessica Alba, what you have is a terrifically gorgeous woman who convinces us that she's a good actress.
There's a stretch.
I mean, you know,
I wouldn't describe X-Files, though, as documentary television compared to, comic book characters. I mean, there is a certain whimsical quality to X-Files. Do you believe in unexplained phenomena?
Personally, do I believe in unexplained?
Have you been abducted?
I don't want to talk about that on air. They might come back.
How do you think she ended up here in the studio?
not that kind of abduction.
The Men in Black will come for me if I talk about it. Yes. No, I'm not a particular...
The takeaway booking department. The abductors.
I was just going to say.
Abductors.
We call them producers, Rebecca.
That's weird. They scared
me. All right,
me.
So let's wind this up here. What is the conclusion? Where do we go from here vis-a-vis geeky, smart, sexy characters in the movie?
We go to see the few movies that have those characters in them. We send a message to Hollywood that we like those characters and that we're willing to pay to see them. And that's the thing that really works in Hollywood.
Money.
And you're going to see it. X-Files opens tomorrow, right?
X-Files opens on Friday. And yes, I will go to see it. I haven't seen it yet. I will go to see it. And if it's good, I'll go to see it again. Again, money, ticket sales, anything that people pay for, Hollywood will make again and again and again.
All right. Phenomena explained.
Yeah, partially. Thank you, Rebecca. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Traister, writer for Salon.com.
Estrogen rave. I love estrogen rave. We're talking presidential candidates today. We're talking geeks in the movies, big screen or little screen. Senator McCain is in Ohio to talk to voters. Senator Barack Obama is in Berlin to talk to Germans. The question on everyone's mind, is the media in the tank with Senator Obama? Jay wrote to our website, given the polls, I think the media correctly see Obama as the likely next president of the United States and are treating him accordingly. They're not in the tank, but rather in the know. We're a part of the vast conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine?
Also in today's conversation, what you should know about caring for an elderly parent, a bit of debate over Pakistan terror funding, a Starbucks closes and devastates a Chicago community. But it isn't like clapping your hands for Tinkerbell and the Starbucks comes back. And a new X-Files. That's right, Billy Goat. A new X-Files movie opens this weekend. Do you believe still?
If you missed anything in today's program, you can catch up with us on iTunes and Friend Feed, or sign up to be abducted.
Or you can sign up for our weekly email newsletter. It's all at www.thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. I yearn to be abducted, but no one will abduct me.
I don't
have ramps on.
I let you into
saucers.
The estrogen halo, and all you can do is whine about how you weren't abducted.
You don't
what
have
do
the key
want?
To the estrogen halo.
Uh-huh. You're locked out. You're
no,
gone, mister.
No, I got it a
next
long time
hour.
Ago.
Uh-huh.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.